Our film critic John Powers just got back from the Toronto Film Festival, where he got to see many of the films that will be opening this season. We asked him to preview what's in store for us this fall, but first, let's find out where Toronto fits in on the film festival circuit.
Well, I think at the moment, the Toronto Film Festival is considered to be the great North American film festival. It got started, I believe, in the late 70s or early 80s, you know, back when Canada seemed to have a lot of money. And unlike the United States, the Canadian government has always put a lot of money into cultural things. So in the early days, it was called initially the Festival of Festivals. And what they would try to do is basically glean the best thing from all the other festivals and show it at one, in one city. So whereas the New York Film Festival will show 25 films, the Toronto Film Festival this year will show 300. And basically everything that was going to be in the New York Film Festival will be there, but there will also be 275 other films. So people come from all over the world because this may be one of the great places to see the films that have sort of been pre-selected.
So did you see a lot of the films that we'll be seeing in the fall season?
Yeah, well, they actually this year were showing quite a few. And I think one of the strange things that's happened this year in Toronto was that normally when you go to a festival, there are all the kind of arty films which you don't normally get to see, and often they're better than the big commercial films. This year at Toronto, I think almost everyone's favorite films tended to be the films that are coming out this fall. So L.A. Confidential, which is being much hyped these days, a film called Boogie Nights, the Anthony Hopkins adventure thriller The Edge, and various other films were all playing at the festival, and pretty much as a rule, those are the films that critics and audiences liked best.
Well, we'll talk about L.A. Confidential later this week. Tell me more about Boogie Nights, which you described as a porno epic. It's a movie about the porn industry?
Yes, Boogie Nights is a film about the San Fernando Valley porn industry in the late 70s and early 1980s. And it's basically the story of a young guy whose mother and whose family have told him that he'll never amount to anything. But the one thing that he has going for him are the qualities that make someone a male porn star. And he gets hooked up in the late 70s with an idealistic porno producer played by Burt Reynolds in the best that Burt Reynolds has been in years and years and years. And this idealistic porn producer dreams of making a porn film so good that people will stay in the theater all the way through. Okay, and he's kind of a utopian porn person. This guy hooks up, and basically what you get is something like a Goodfellas of pornography, where you actually watch a guy's arc moving into the business, it developing, and then it falling apart. In another way, it's kind of like the Robert Altman film, Shortcuts, because it actually interweaves a whole series of stories. So it actually, in some sense, is a film of epic scope about all these people who are involved in the pornography business in the kind of idealistic days of the 70s. And then when things got nastier and nastier in the 80s, when drugs started hitting more, the bottom fell out of the business because you could no longer shoot on film because it was much cheaper to shoot on video. And all of a sudden, the whole thing got cheesier and nastier. It was made by a young guy by the name of Paul Thomas Anderson, who earlier this year had a film called Hard Eight. But this is a film that I think will do for him what Pulp Fiction did for Quentin Tarantino. I think once this film comes out, he will be one of the young filmmakers, maybe the young filmmaker, that all the young filmmakers who are, let's say, 16 to 22 want to be. Well, I mean, it's that kind of film.
Hard Eight was terrific.
Oh, Hard Eight is terrific. And if you take the talent that was there and simply expand it out, and realize that he was telling something in a small story very well. He's now telling a huge story. And it doesn't always work. It must be said that he's so ambitious in this film that there's probably too much stuff in it. There are too many storylines, too many twists, too much excitement. Yet when you're watching it, you can tell you're in the presence of this major talent.
Do you know when it's opening here?
It's opening in the middle of October. And it's a movie that I think people will argue about. Some people really can't stand it. Most people seem to like it quite a lot.
What else did you find really good and surprising at the festival?
Well, actually, David Mamet wrote a script for an adventure story called The Edge, which I liked quite a lot. Anthony Hopkins plays a multi-billionaire reader who gets involved in a plane crash in Alaska, along with Alec Baldwin, who he thinks may be trying to kill him in order to steal his wife and his money. And basically, it's about civilized guys in the Alaskan wilderness having to do battle against the elements in order to survive. And, you know, what's interesting about it is that this is really a classic intellectual sort of fantasy, because the Anthony Hopkins character is able to survive because he's read all these books that teach you how to survive in the wilderness. And I remember, like, when I was, you know, growing up a fat, you know, 12 or 13-year-old, nothing would have appealed to me more in the world than the idea that having read all these books was going to make me more of a man than someone like Alec Baldwin.
And Mamet knows about braving the elements because he lives in Vermont part of the year.
Yes, exactly. There have been times. He's been in weather so bad, the wind has whipped the beret from his head. He really does know about the roughness of the elements. And you can actually tell this is clearly Mamet's boy's own, sort of boy's life version of himself, the Anthony Hopkins character. And what's actually nice about it is that Anthony Hopkins is often a wonderful actor, but I think he's never more wonderful than when he's doing good pop culture stuff.
Oh, as opposed to the big roles, like
yes, somehow him. Anthony Hopkins is less fun as Pablo Picasso than he is as a multi-billionaire who has to seem smarter than everybody else in the movie. Because one of the things Hopkins is really good at is underplaying in a very powerful way. That, you know, he's a guy whose power always seems hidden. And in a film like this, Alec Baldwin is all braggadocio, and Hopkins is able to just sort of look at him. But there's so much pressure behind the eyes when Hopkins is acting well that you realize that he's actually tougher.
So when is this Mamet movie opening?
It, too, is opening in early October. It's actually a real treat to be able to say that there are all these good movies coming out.
What were the big disappointments at the Toronto Film Festival?
Well, I think, you know, maybe the big disappointment was the film 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, which, you know, was at the very end of the festival and people were really revved up to see it. And, you know, Brad was going to come. And, you know, that, you know, since stars are what people love, you know, and Brad is one of the big stars. You know, he's Brad. He's not Brad Pitt. And so people were really revved up. Then people saw the film. They thought, it's made by this French guy, Jean-Jacques Annaud, and he still can't direct very well. And, well, Brad, you know, he's a very kind of fashion-conscious teacher of the Dalai Lama. And people began making fun of it, and they were saying, oh, you know, really, Brad can't quite do the Austrian accent, really, can he? And, you know, by the end, it went from being this kind of big thing to something that kind of deflated. Which is the risk of a festival. I know that one of the things that happens periodically at Toronto is that there'll be a film that no one in the world has seen. And the producers have taken the big risk of bringing it into the Toronto audience, figuring that the Toronto audience will love it, and then the distributors will see this and it'll increase its market value. There were a couple films that happened with this year. One is a film called The Apostle, made by Robert Duvall, which is about a preacher. And there's another one called Mr. Jealousy, made by a young guy by the name of Noah Baumbach. And the risk they are taking is that the audience will love it. Now, in previous years, I've actually been there when people have brought films in and the audience didn't love it. And you watch them go from standing on the stage, introducing their film, thinking, we're going to make millions and millions and millions of dollars, to sort of cringing in the corner at the end, realizing they'll be lucky to have a distributor, that this may be one of the rare showings of the film in the world. You know, so it's a very high-stakes thing to do. And, you know, this year, the Robert Duvall film, you know, was acquired almost immediately after it screened for quite a lot of money. And I believe the same thing will happen with the film Mr. Jealousy. They were films that clearly played well with the Toronto audience, and people snapped up. And it's exciting to be in a screening room somehow when you're there and probably 90% of the people who are there are just ordinary people. But the other 10% are all the people who have the money to decide who's going to distribute the film. And they kind of huddle with one another. You can see them huddling before the screening. You see them sort of whispering. And then afterwards, they sort of like get in little kind of clutches of people, once again, whispering to one another. And they're passing messages to the filmmaker, I'd like to meet so-and-so in my hotel room. You know, and it all seems very glamorous. And you realize that for them, this is the sexiest part of their business. That for film distributors, the idea that you're all sitting in the same room, and to some extent, sort of wooing the same lover, and that this is your chance to win, is for them like the highlight of their lives. You can actually, their faces are kind of, they have that kind of shine of people who are a little bit excited, you know, and they both are louder than usual and quieter than usual. And it's actually very fun to be in watching the process.
I know there's a couple of Henry James movies that are opening this season. Have you seen them?
Yes, I have, actually. It's funny to realize that, you know, that we're now in the midst of the Henry James boom following the Jane Austen boom. And these films are quite different. One is basically Washington Square, which has been made a lot of times. It's really The Heiress. This stars Jennifer Jason Leigh in the role of the young woman with the bullying father who falls in love with someone, and then the father doesn't want her to be involved with it. This has always been a story that's rather easy to do dramatically. Unlike a lot of Henry James things, it's rather straightforward, and it's easy to dramatize. Quite a few people liked that film, although I wasn't wild about it. I was actually more interested in a film, the film version of The Wings of the Dove, which I think for most people would be, well, you know, one of those Henry James novels they find completely unreadable. I think actually, if I can just say parenthetically, one of the funny things that you're going to look forward to when the film comes out in November are a bunch of film critics who wouldn't have been caught dead reading Wings of the Dove attacking this film version of Wings of the Dove as if they would ever read Henry James unless they were being paid to do it. But what's interesting about this is one of the most refined and almost effete of the James novels, where the action is described in such abstract language that you can sort of read it over and over again and think, what's really going on here? This has been pared down until it's something like Dangerous Liaisons, about a pair of lovers and a young American heiress, and more or less how they're trying to manipulate her so they can stay together but get her money. And it's actually even got things that are very un-Henry James-like, such as an extended nude scene. And I know the James people are going to go berserk when they see the film. It'll actually be worth, I look forward to reading the op-ed piece by someone like Cynthia Ozick in the New York Times as she's talking about the betrayal of the great artist Henry James by this film. Nevertheless, it's a really enjoyable film.
I know that there's sometimes when a new movie season seems to be dominated by movies of the past year or two, the successful movies. Everybody tries to go out, figure out what the formula is, and make movies that fit that formula. Is there any formula that seems to be dominating this season's new movies?
Well, I think what's interesting is that I think the success of The English Patient has at least changed the way people now talk about certain kinds of movies. I think no one before The English Patient was made would have thought of it as being the kind of movie that was going to make a lot of money and win Oscars. Now the literary adaptations of a high-toned kind are now seen in a different light than they were before. Somehow there's a way in which we always do tend to read the present films in light of the past films. So suddenly Wings of the Dove is the romantic costume drama that Miramax has this year. And so therefore it will be treated in the same way. There's another film based on the Peter Carey novel called Oscar and Lucinda that's coming out this fall. It's an Australian Victorian thing that has Ralph Fiennes, therefore linking the connection to The English Patient. And it too is always discussed as, will this be the Fox Searchlight winner of the English Patient Academy Award?
My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers. Well, John, I want to hear about a movie that's opening this weekend that I know you've already seen, and that's 1,000 Acres, which is based on a Jane Smiley novel. I have to say, I've seen the coming attractions for this, and just from seeing the coming attractions, it seems to me, forgive me for shooting from the hip here, but that they've taken this like closely observed Jane Smiley fiction and made it into like a scenic family saga with, you know, all the wheat waving in the background and... How'd you like it?
Well, you'll be actually glad to know that there isn't nearly as much waving wheat as you might fear from the trailer. I think what Disney is trying to do with the trailer is to convince people they're not going to see a film that's as depressing as the film actually is. I think this is another of the literary adaptations which are very, you know, very popular these days. And a lot of people have read the books. I don't think I need to describe it in great detail. It's basically a retelling of King Lear set on an Iowa farm. And it's basically the story of three sisters, but rather than having Cordelia be the heroic sister, there's the suggestion that the other two sisters have been badly treated by the father, so that it isn't just pure feminine evil that leads them to betray the father, but in fact that it's the father's own crimes against them that more or less causes the problems. And you know, Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer play the two sisters who are normally considered to be the evil sisters, and they're extraordinarily good in the film. The film itself is a bit timid. I think one of the problems with a film version of something like 1,000 Acres is that the material is so aggressive and strong that Hollywood begins backing away from it the moment that it buys the book. Yet in the very process of making the thing into a film, it becomes a bit more of a story about two sisters' friendship rather than the incredible friendship and profound, almost murderous hostility between the two sisters. That anyone who's read the book will know precisely the scenes in the book that are missing in the film, because basically the film in some way chickens out and wasn't very well made, to put it simply. And yet in the middle of it, it has perhaps two of the great screen actresses of the last 20 years who are very different kinds of actresses. I mean, Pfeiffer is quite, you know, she's an old-style Hollywood star actress, yet she's good, I think. And Jessica Lange is a real, she's sort of the Bessie Smith of contemporary screen actresses, and she's always giving her heart. I mean, sometimes she gives her heart too much. I think she even thinks probably that at times she just throws herself into a role too completely. In this particular case, their styles work perfectly because the intensely emotional style of Lange as the kind of lost sister plays very nicely off the style of Pfeiffer as the colder, brittler, angrier sister.
They seem to make a lot of sense cast as sisters.
Yes, they actually look very much like sisters, and they have both that mixture of connection and difference, so that you actually can sense that they would know each other so intimately that they couldn't stand one another and love one another, and that's kind of the feeling you get with them, and it's actually very nice to see, because one of the strange things about movies, and probably has been true for the last 20 or 30 years, is that it's astounding how often major actors and actresses don't appear together. You know, it always seems like a special event when you get two people who are good in the same movie. And this may be because of movie star egos, you know, so that when you get two people, they each have their rewriters trying to redo the script to make them seem better. Yes, you know, I mean, if you think of, or even a film like Heat, where Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, you know, were finally together on screen for the first time, I think the amount of time they were on screen in that film, which was a 3-hour film, was about 1 minute. You know, even in their scenes together, it was shot in a way where they weren't on the screen at the same time. It was actually one person talking in his close-up, then the other person talking in his close-up. And it's hard to know whether that's the actor's vanity, whether it's just cheaper to light it that way, or what it is. But it's very rare that you actually have a scene like several of the scenes in Thousand Acres, where you have these two major people side by side on a sofa, where they're both interacting with one another, kind of as if it were a live performance almost. Which is the way, in fact, that movies in Hollywood used to be. You know, 40 years ago, you would put Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell together, and they would go for 5 minutes, the camera wouldn't move, and they'd be doing everything. And if they did it wrong, you had to do it again. Whereas now, that's a really rare and exciting thing to see.
An interesting point. Well, John, I look forward to hearing your reviews of new movies as they open during the fall. Thanks a lot for giving us this preview, and happy movie going.
Well, thanks.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue. He'll be back with us on Thursday to review the new film L.A. Confidential, which opens this weekend. On Thursday, we'll also be joined by the film's director, Curtis Hanson, and star, Russell Crowe. The soundtrack includes some great recordings from the 50s. We'll close with one, Lee Wiley singing Looking at You. I'm Cherie Groves.